Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal along with Eagle One. And thank you again, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. As a reminder to those who are joining us live, if you could scroll down to the show page if you're there and join in the chat room with the usual suspects. That's a great place if during the course of the show there's a question you would like for us to ask or an observation or a point of order. That's a great place to bring it in. Both Eagle One and myself will be monitoring the show page during the show, and we will pick it up and fold it in as we go forward. And if you're new to Midrats, want to catch up on some previous shows, or you have to leave halfway through the show, you can always get the archive on Blog Talk Radio, or you can pick it up via the free podcast on iTunes. Also, on occasion, our show will go a little longer than 60 minutes. The show will die live right at the 60-minute mark, but you can pick up the last few remaining minutes on the archive or over on the podcast. So fear not if we're halfway through a juicy little topic. We'll let you know in the chat room how many minutes we'll go over. Now let's get on with the show. The Naval Experience is a fertile ground for any author, whether you're talking about contemporary events, nonfiction, history, or even fiction. And our guest today is one of the best when it comes to mining the raw material that a life exposed to the sea service can bring to an author. Captain R.L. Crossland, United States Navy, retired. He is a SEAL, but with 35 years of service, both active and reserved, with a real broad scope that we're going to try to tap in this afternoon, from Vietnam all the way up to modern Afghanistan. He's widely published on maritime unconventional warfare and naval history, including the U.S. Naval Institute's Proceedings magazines and the New York Times, among his credits. He also holds a Merchant Marine Captain's license, and just in case you want to hug him too much, he is a practicing trial lawyer, though we won't hold that against him. Following his Cold War novel, Red Ice, he has his latest novel, Jade Rooster. It is a mystery set in the Asiatic fleet circa 1913. And you can find a link to all those either over at the show page or on my home blog, or you can go straight to the book's webpage, www.dreadnoughts-bluejackets.com. Roger, welcome to Midrats.
Oh, I'm glad to be here on Bastille Day plus one.
Exactly. It's funny if you ever find yourself living in Europe on Bastille Day and go, hey, let's go to the beach. It's not the same. It's, I think the highs in the Channel Coast today are maybe 68, 66, but it's a good excuse to have a 14 July celebration.
Well, I'm celebrating it this weekend by being on your show.
Well, thank you very much. Hey, the... I thought what was interesting about your latest book, Jade Rooster, is with the rise of China economically, militarily, and the latest strategic look, the refocus or the pivot to the Pacific, China and the Western Pacific, a lot in the news, and you would think a fiction writer, he might pick a contemporary time frame or maybe slightly in the future. But for your novel, you've gone back to the period right before World War I kicked off. As an author, what drew your attention to that time frame, and what advantage did that get to you to flesh out your storyline?
Well, I started out writing contemporary or near contemporary action adventure with Red Ice. But I found it very constraining because I was writing about SEALs, and even though I removed the SEALs from active duty, this was sort of post-active duty service. I was always worried that I was getting a little too close to what shouldn't be said. And, you know, I had a tug of war between making things as accurate as possible and not saying too much. After Red Ice, I wrote another novel and a half, and then I said, I'm not going to do this anymore on spec. I'm going to write in a safer time period. Now, one of the least known but probably most interesting, maybe most glorious periods of the Steel Navy was the China sailors. And they still talked of China sailors when I was on active duty, that they were something apart and something special. I know as a midshipman I saw Sand Pebbles and just thought it was a great movie and very interesting. And Asia at that time was what today we'd call a conflict of culture. So many things are coming together and competing, and it just makes a great backdrop. There's intrigue, there's foreign cultures and cultural conflicts. I know in practicing law, sometimes I'd get a client that was from someplace else, and they'd wonder why I would want to represent them. And I said, I'm a sailor. I didn't go halfway around the world to see people and meet with people and deal with people who are just like me. That one of the great allures of being in the Navy was seeing the world and seeing other people. There used to be a competition between sailors as to who knew the most exotic customs and most exotic taboos. And every time a ship went into port, before we ever were allowed to go ashore, somebody would get on the 1MC and give us a list of things you're not supposed to do. And that made it interesting, and the old-timers would footnote all that and say, oh, no, you can't cross your ankles, or you can't, don't say this to the women. So it made life interesting. And here is a great backdrop. And the more I spent talking to civilians after I got off active duty, they hadn't a clue. And they got the TV version or the movie version of what the Navy was like. And it was just all wrong. It's far more sophisticated. You watch kids playing sailor or soldier, and you know, one's barking at the other, and you got to do that, I'm your superior officer. Well, anyone who's been an officer, especially a senior officer, knows that he can say things, but there's always a way, if it's an unpopular command, that he's going to hear about it or feel something from the ranks. They're not going to let it go easy. That there's always a dynamic of give and take. And all of that is sort of lost on the American public that is having less and less exposure to the military. We've got a shrinking military. Fewer, my generation, everybody's dad served. But the next generation, the Vietnam generation, succeeding generations, people have less and less familiarity with the military. So to me, it seemed like a very fertile area. And there were two things I wanted to show, sort of the dynamics of military decisions and decision-making, and how intercultural relations is always a big factor, perhaps in the Navy more than in others, but there's you're it isn't a chess game. In war, you know, there a lot of people say, there's the enemy and there's you. And it's like a football game. Nobody goes outside the borders. Nobody rushes onto the field from the sidelines. None of that. Well, in real war, in real military operations, you're not only looking straight at the enemy, you better be looking on a 360 perimeter, keeping track of all the players and what their agendas are and how why they need you and why they like you or why they don't need you and why they dislike you. So it seemed like a fertile area. Plus, since I'm writing on spec, it's got to be an area that interests me. I'm living vicariously the adventures I write. So I'm not going to write about anything that is not exciting to me. And this was a part of the world. I deployed to Vietnam, to Korea. I'd been in Japan. I'd been in the Philippines and on active duty. And then as a reservist, I spent a lot of time in Korea, 10 trips to Korea. So Korea was a place I knew in particular. I'd visited China, and I'd studied judo in Japan with the Navy's help. So all these areas were interesting to me. I liked, and as I said, if I was going to write, I might as well write about something that caught my attention.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the research you were able to do to recreate 1913, the Asiatic fleet, I guess it was in those days. Where did you find the materials, and how long did it take you to do the research or write the book?
Well, I was fortunate enough to, in my last drilling years as a reservist, be sent to the Naval Historical Center in Washington, the gun factory. And so their library was just chock full of diaries and different reference books that made it fairly easy to get a sense of what was going on at that time. That's how I knew the Bureau of Navigation supervised both coal ships and naval intelligence, which seemed an odd chain of command. I'm also, or was at the time, also a member of the Japan Society, so I went to the Japan Society when I needed maps in Japan. I had to, there's a sequence that takes place in Yokohama in 1913, and I could get maps out. I find if I can get my hands on a period map, I can visualize far easier the demographics of the city that I'm dealing with. And then I'd always be reading. I think I read about used to read about 30 books for every 10 pages of copy, and I'm always pulling something out of what I'm reading. In fact, it hurts my fiction style because I'm always reading nonfiction. That is primarily where the research was coming from. Now, some people think you outline a historic novel by determining your setting and your characters and then researching every little aspect. What happens, or at least in my case happens, is I go where the street lamp is. In other words, there's an old story about somebody losing their keys on a dark night. And somebody comes to help them, and they ask, well, where'd you lose your keys? Oh, I lost them over there. Well, why are you searching here? Well, it's easier to search here. Well, when you write a story, or when I write a story, if I can find a book that is very helpful on a certain area, well, then the book is going to steer to that area as a setting. If I tried to research an obscure village in China and there's nothing on it, I don't feel comfortable writing about that. I'm not giving the reader, at least, it's not honest. I try and give them setting and background that I've researched and is actually happened or came close to happening. I'll read a bunch of books, come up with a rough outline, and know I can write the story. And then I try and fill in spots from having read a diary or perhaps other fiction of someone who knew the area. But most of the time it's nonfiction I'm using as a background. So essentially, I go to where the street lamps are and construct a story. I don't just say, well, I am going to write about Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, on the 2 weeks before the Battle of Gettysburg. If there aren't diaries or books that are going to give me something to work from, then it's just a potboiler. I'm pulling it out of the air. And I try not to do that. But you have to extrapolate from time to time that you know this and you know that, and then you say, well, it's very likely that something happened in between, and I can wing it. But I try to avoid that as much as possible.
Roger, you mentioned something real interesting in response to my first question. I wanted to revisit here because I talk and exchange email with junior officers on a regular basis. Mostly they're interested in doing small articles and things like that. But in the course of conversations with many of them, like a lot of people who have a drive to write, they feel like they have a novel in them. Now, a lot of them are more comfortable with nonfiction because they've had some experiences that they want to put down. But some of them want to use their background in a way to write what may be more difficult, which is nonfiction. But they're in a little bit of a conflict that I think that you've had to deal with as well, because you'll see some people will give the advice, write what you know. Well, in this line of work, you've got to be extremely careful about writing about what or commenting about what you know for classification reasons, and also it's hard to be able to keep your life compartmentalized. And in your first book, like you mentioned, you were pretty close to what your professional background was, but your second, not so much. What advice would you give to a young writer who feels like they have a novel in them and people are trying to encourage them to do the write what you know, but what they've been involved with, they probably don't want to declassify to that extent? How can they get into a rhythm of stepping outside of their direct sphere of understanding and work forward to a novel? And also, could you speak up a little bit? Some of our listeners are having trouble hearing you.
Well, writing out, are you saying writing as a naval officer but in an area that is not your specialty? I'm not sure I follow the question.
Yeah, correct. For instance, somebody who has a lot of experience, let's say, in submarine operations, but they're interested in writing a novel that involves the periphery of their understanding and what they've been exposed to secondhand, but they don't want to write about. They don't want to put a submarine novel out there, though they do want to put a maritime focused novel out there.
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. That the dynamics of a naval air organization or a naval special warfare organization or a naval submarine organization, I think, are very similar. You know, how decisions get made, how a staff works, how a CO and XO might work. One of the things is the traditions of the service make us far more common or have more things in common than differences. The technology changes, and perhaps the hardware, but the way a naval staff works and how the chief staff officer asks his project officers to report things to the commander, you can go from one naval organization to the next, and it's going to be pretty much the same. And there's always the quirks of personality. You know, the naval organization, you have your plain vanilla picture of what a naval officer is like. But if you've been in any naval organization, there's the eccentric, there's the nerd, there's the jock, and all of that doesn't change too much.
Yeah, we're not short of personalities, that's for sure.
No, and a lot do not hide their personalities, and the system, in day-to-day life, everybody likes that. Oh, what crazy Joe do on Liberty? Have you heard the story? As long as it's within bounds, the organization kind of enjoys it. We all wear the same uniforms, but nobody wants everybody to be the same. It takes all the energy away from the organization. So if you're a submariner writing about surface line, all you do is change the breast device on your character, and I'm sure surface line has got a character just like you remember stealing strawberries out of the galley. Those guys are in all, from top to bottom, all naval organizations. And there's mischief afoot. There's always somebody trying to pull something. There's always the entrepreneur trying to figure out how to sacrifice for his country and make himself rich. There are all sorts of characters that are almost universal. The naval novelist with some background, with some core background, shouldn't have any trouble. Now, he's going to have to make up some things if it's, highly classified or highly technical and somehow waltz around it. But in terms of the characterization, he can merge a couple people he really knows into a character, and that character will be recognizable by someone in another specialty.
When you first started writing, and I have a piece of yours, I think from the American Spectator, if I'm not mistaken, back in the 1970s. Did you start out writing nonfiction and articles of interest, and then work your way around to fiction? How did you get started as a writer in general?
I kind of went both ways simultaneously. I had two parallel routes. When I went to Vietnam, I took a manual typewriter and did the famous writer's course. And so I was thinking fiction at the time. Now, that American Spectator's article. I left it with a friend, and his name is on it too. And he added some stuff that made it less coherent. But I was always writing on two parallel tracks. I've found nonfiction is far easier to sell. And most of the time, anytime I wrote anything that was really good and got published, it was because I was mad as hell. Something had happened. And I said, I got to write, put this on paper. We're getting screwed here. And sure enough, it would get published. If I was benign about it, those articles hardly ever got published. But if I was mad, they got picked up.
I think that's a great point. The passion. And a little bit of what I like to call the creative friction in writing is really critical, I think, to not only make something impactful, make people think and to ponder, but I think also just to motivate people to want to write as opposed to sit there and stew in your juices. When you mentioned taking a manual typewriter to Vietnam, I had visions of the character from Band of Brothers when he gets picked up on D-Day to not Band of Brothers, Saving Private Ryan, excuse me, where he come and grabbed and tries to take his typewriter with him on patrol. And going back, and that's one of the neat things about having you as a guest, Roger, is you have a good depth of experience. And just deviating a little bit from the book here, on your personal experience, when you look at the SEALs from Vietnam and how they operated, how they experienced their day-to-day operations. If you were to take a SEAL and let's give him a snapshot of 1971-72, and if he was magically transported 40 years into the future today amongst his SEAL brothers and a SEAL team that exists in 2012, what would he find the most similar and familiar to him? What were those things that he would find the most exciting professionally and a neat tool and asset that he would have available to he and his team members? And is there anything there that he would be most perplexed by or would think was missing from what existed 40 years ago?
Wow, I could do a whole 2 hours on that, but let me give it a shot. When I came in 1970, no one would have ever thought that we'd have a SEAL officer that would make Admiral lower list. And now we've had two SEAL officers make full Admiral. And that would be, by itself, I'm not a careerist, but by itself that shows where in the pecking order we've risen to, that in the 70s and earlier, we were always sort of orphans with a very low budget. We were actually often encouraged to midnight requisition gear because we just couldn't get it, or we spent a lot of time building and improvising gear. There was very little R&D support, and now, geez, the sky's the limit. The type of specialized gear just oriented towards special operations is phenomenal. That the operators then coming to the present would never believe some of the gear and money expended in our direction. I talked about how nervous, how angry I was in 79 and 81 when I wrote The Rusty Hand of Steel and Unconventional Warfare Afloat. What was happening then was I was in the reserve, and the reserve was treated as the enemy. That one admiral said, a dollar to the reserves is a dollar to the Russians. That they the active duty SEALs saw the reserve SEALs as a competitor, and they were very nervous that the whole SEAL mission would be put into the reserves. One thing Naval Special Warfare has done is survive very well, that after World War II, or by the end of World War II, all special operations units, with the exception of UDT, had been disbanded. You know, the Army Rangers didn't exist. The Marine Raiders didn't exist. And what we were lucky in is our godfather, Draper Kaufman, had been regular and had gone to the Naval Academy and had made admiral. So he justified our existence. And the other thing that protected us was we weren't in competition with a regular Navy. We weren't stealing senior petty officers from the fleet. The Army always worried about having special operations units, that the special operations would be skimming off the best talent in the NCO ranks. So we were pretty good at surviving, but we had no budget, and nobody could imagine how to use us. That we had won World War II on our ability to throw a heck of a lot of ordnance and steel in the direction of the enemy. That it was big conventional warfare that had won World War II for us and looked like it was going to be our way of fighting wars forever and ever. So special operations was just a sideshow. So now everything has changed. When we don't have a draft and we've got career super operators and the enemy is not a nation but an organization that ostensibly has no state sponsor, suddenly this was our war. The global war on terrorism put us on the front burner, and we were in the right place at the right time, and we had come to a level of financing and organization that we were ready. We were ready to pick up the ball. Now, what has stayed the same? I can go in and talk to a bunch of petty officers or junior officers, and they're just the same as they've always been. They run to the sound of the guns. They like challenges. They're adventurous. They're physical, but also intellectual at the same time. It's kind of a funny balance. But the personalities don't change. And now one of the scary things is we figure 2-3% of every age group will qualify for special operations, either SEALs or Green Berets or something like that. But once you try and stretch it beyond that, all of a sudden you start having problems. So one of the great problems is going to be expectations, that I hope no one believes SEALs can win all wars for us. That's just never going to work. We need other types of soldiers and sailors and Marines. You've got to have a full menu. We can't put our whole national defense on special operations, because as soon as we do that, the enemy, whoever the enemy ends up being, is going to say, well, okay, they put all their eggs in this one basket. We're going to head them somewhere else. So the expectations, and every fictional hero or everybody on TV that was served in the service all of a sudden is a SEAL. When I got out in 1974, every time I said SEAL, I'd say, you know, it's kind of like UDT. People knew what UDT was. They didn't know what SEALs are. Now you mention UDT, no one knows what that is, and everybody knows what a SEAL is. And, heck, with all the people saying they're SEALs, only a small fraction of those were ever SEALs.
Well, that kind of leads to a couple of questions. One is, did you see the movie Act of Valor, and did you like it? And the second one is, your short pieces that were in Proceedings, SEAL type operations, if you will, but naval raids and stuff. Do you went through historical reasons why those were valid ideas, and I guess you were attempting to justify at the time the role of special operations forces. But as we engage with potentially a larger force of the Chinese, what role would do you see the special warfare community having in such a world that we seem to be coming up on?
Well, I got to remember all the question. I have not seen.
I can restate it for you later on and change everything in it.
I have not seen the movie. I've read a critique of it by one of my friends, Bob Schultz, who says one of the problems is they telescope about 10 different missions into one. And no platoon would be given that succession of linked missions to handle all at once. It's just too much, too intense. But, of course, you're making a movie. You want to capture people's interest. So it is it's a little exaggerated in that way, as I understand it. Now, as far as China goes, well, China has ports, and I think China may step over the line somewhere in Asia. And the way to support countries in Asia at some point is going to have to be maritime. So preparing or defending whoever we're protecting in Asia is going to have to involve naval forces. And we, you know, initially China is going to be very strong when it's on its own home ground in its own backyard. And so slipping people in to throw the Chinese off balance, should we... This is all hypothetical. I mean, nobody knows that they are going to come across as a threat, though a lot of people are a little uneasy about the way they're going in developing a far stronger Navy. But naval targets are going to be easier to go after at a long distance with special operations, especially when the targets are soft. In other words, capturing people, rescuing people, putting something somewhere that helps us monitor their conduct. It may be that some of our high-tech stuff can't get inside China. They may have electronic defenses that, you know, we're thinking now we've got these high-tech items that are going to be able to touch anywhere in the world. Well, there may be a point where our ability to do that is denied. And so you're going to have to send people to do the work. Special operations in big wars tends to be focused on going into places that are, for some reason or other, denied otherwise.
Hello?
Yeah, I think one of the neat things that I think people are still trying to get their heads around in the last few years, we've always had good bilateral relationships with the Japanese since World War II. Obviously, we're very insular. That has started to change. We've also had a good bilateral relationship with the South Koreans. And I think what's really interesting is Japan and South Korea have animosity going back hundreds of years, are starting to coordinate and dance together a little more. And we've seen, especially in the naval special warfare arena in general, in the last decade, we've done a lot with the Filipinos. And you see the Philippines, Japan, and South Korea, and we've recently had another nation in that area, Vietnam. Started slowly, but each year we seem to be working with them, coordinating more with them. And those types of relationships seem to really play into what are one of the core competencies of not just naval special warfare, but special warfare in general, and that's working with partner nations and a small footprint, big impact, especially with the growing and, frankly, friendly relationship we're having with the government of Vietnam. How can that potentially change some of the way that our special warfare communities have been operating in the last decade, and is it kind of a return to the past to a certain extent?
Well, I'm concerned as to under what circumstances we leave Afghanistan and we leave Iraq. These countries have got to be thinking all the time, where is this going? Where does our friendship with the U.S. go? Are we going to be supported and then abandoned when it becomes inconvenient, or are we going to be supported? And I can't say where special operations fits in that mix and that question that is going to be coming to the leadership in Japan, Korea, and the Philippines and Vietnam, that they've got to always be wondering where are we going to stand in the long haul, that the U.S. is a good friend and then all of a sudden turns its back on you. And that is going to be a big problem. Now, it's right now in their self-interest to want to counter the growing interest in China for oil. And there are quite a few islands and territories that are in dispute with the economic zones. How special operations is going to fit in that may be in the intelligence gathering area that they'll be able to monitor China's pulse or show these countries how to monitor China's pulse to get accurate information. And intelligence is, there are people that look on intelligence as always something dark. Sometimes intelligence is good. It keeps people from vilifying a country that maybe shouldn't be vilified. On the other hand, it may tell you, oh boy, these guys have bad intentions. But I think the more intelligence and the more sophisticated a country can get in gathering intelligence and analyzing it, the better. So special operations can help them become more sophisticated. And you're not going to be able to get a blue-eyed Caucasian into China unnoticed, but you might be able to get a member of one of those countries into China or in a country in between and have that party get useful information. So then you know where to put your assets, know where to put your hopes. Sorge in Japan, as used by the Russians, allowed them to move divisions to the Western Front when they were worried that Japan might get into the war. So just knowing things is useful, and special operations has often been used for helping countries know things.
You had an interesting piece, I guess, in the New York Times about the irrevocability of some decisions, and you kind of contrasted what you do as a civilian lawyer counseling your clients against find themselves in positions where they can't necessarily get out of what they're getting into, and the decisions that a commander has to make in times of war. And I was curious as to what your thoughts are about lawyering, lawfare, I guess we call it now, as lawyering seems to have taken a front seat in a lot of the issues of our war fighting. Do you think we've got too much lawyering going on, or are we being counseled too much to avoid those irrevocable decisions even when we really need to make them? What's your view on that?
I agree we got too much lawyering going on, and Donald Rumsfeld put an end to a lot of that in special operations when he threw a phone out a window after I guess they had Mullah Omar in their sights, and someone asked if you could launch a missile at him. And they caught the staff lawyer on the phone, and he said no. Wars aren't fought by laws, and as much as I am a proponent of the rule of law in within the borders of the United States, I think the emphasis on law in war is misplaced. Yeah, there's got to be some guidance. Yes, there's got to be some rules, et cetera. Any large organization has to have some rules. But I think we've had legal creep go into our decision-making. And the trouble is a lot of it is bad legal creep, that the law of war would not have precluded us from going after command structure, and Mullah Omar was a member of it. So it wasn't so much law as it was the wrong lawyer who didn't have a good sense of what the law was. But, you know, when lives are in national defense and hang in the balance, the first thing, it should not be the on-watch commander's first question is, oh, is this legal? I don't know what this is. Well, first thing, he should know, and second, his first question shouldn't be, hey, get that lawyer in here. We got to discuss this. Okay. So people often asked, and I was offered JAG after I got off active duty, and I said no. My instincts are elsewhere. I could not be a JAG lawyer, not when I'd been a SEAL. If nothing else, I always felt SEALs were higher on the pecking order, at least the naval pecking order.
At least you're more likely to have people talk to you at a bar, if nothing else. hey, don't discount free beer. It's a commodity. About back in 1981, you wrote an article, Unconventional Warfare Afloat. I just wanted to touch on for a minute. And I liked, if we could just reflect back and see what is still applicable, what you might have changed in the course of the intervening years, which brought up four particular areas that remain important. That's naval saboteurs, pocket submarines, Trojan seahorses, and a subject that I really feel like Don Quixote with sometimes, diesel boats forever. I don't think enough people talk about recent history, the Brit Upholder class submarine during the first Gulf War, and before they decommissioned them all, the Danish Type 207 boat in the invasion of Iraq. When you look back at that article, what do you think has stood the test of time since you wrote that? And were there to be something else that you would add to it if you were going to write it again in 2012?
Well, I think they've all stood the test of time. Have they all been accepted and employed? No. I know the Trojan horse idea has been implemented. Naval saboteurs, though limpeteer attacks are going to be less and less when with robotics. As far as I'm trying to remember, diesel boats forever. What a problem that is. We Special Operations spent a lot of money on something called the ASDS, which was going to be our own personal submarine. What we have SDVs that can get into ports, but how did you get the SDV close enough to go after, say, a merchant ship with missiles that are going to a bad place? Now, with diesel boats, they can get very quiet. They can go into very shallow areas, so they've got legs. And then you can put an SDV, a wet submarine, for frogmen on it. So I think diesel boats are still a good idea. The problem was, for a long time, the submarine community says, we can get two subs out of Congress a year. They might as well make them nukes. Nukes are the Cadillacs. They're the top of the line. But for special operations, we don't need a Seawolf. I think a couple Baltic diesels would do us a lot more good, and the cost isn't prohibitive. One of the problems is special operations has gotten so sexy, they don't like anything but cutting edge. I've been a great advocate of seaplanes, flying boats, for missions, but that's so World War II, and nobody wants to pick it up and run with it. Diesel boats are considered passe, and they're hard to sell, but I think in terms of special operations, they should be part of our menu.
Well, Roger, after you've written Jade Rooster, what's next on your agenda? Are you working on another book? You've got some other things
I've got another book in the can. It's I've just got to make a couple changes to it and then start marketing it. It is, I call it a straddlequel to Jade Rooster. Some of it occurs before 1913, and the end of it occurs after, just not too long after Jade Rooster's period. Quite a few characters are different. But a lot of it takes place in China and Korea, and a significant portion of it takes place in Imperial China and in the Klondike during the Gold Rush. So I'm hoping to get another historical mystery in the market. These are not good times for publishing, but these are the only times we got.
Yeah, it's that period of time. By far, this is probably sounds very strange for a guy. My favorite warship and one of my favorite stories, nonfiction stories, involves the SMS Emden, the Imperial German light cruiser, part of their Asiatic fleet, and her commerce raiding in the Indian Ocean. Right at the beginning of World War One, I read everything I can about that and Admiral Grosby's rather tragic attempt to get home via the other path. It is a very interesting period of time, both from a nonfiction point of view. I could see where a fiction author, there's a lot of white space there that you can fill in and tell a story and flesh out to that extent. And kind of building on that, as somebody who, you know, like with the Maersk Alabama, you wrote about current events, but you also are a fiction writer, who do you read in the fiction and the nonfiction world just as Roger the person?
About anybody I can who falls into one of my friends is Dick Couch, who's another SEAL officer, actually far more successful than I am. He's got and he's well connected, so he gets a lot of support, I know. And I kidded him about the Sheriff Ramadi, that everybody get all the officers in that book are just great guys and they all get along. And so I got a chuckle out of that. And he didn't say much. Who else am I reading? I'm reading, right now I'm in the middle of reading Kill Bin Laden, which is by a Army Spec Ops officer. Those are the ones that come quickly to mind. Heck, and I read mysteries just for structure and dramatic tension. And heck, the last ones I've been reading are Ian Rankin, who's Scottish, who doesn't fit at all in anything I've written. But as I said, there's certain elements you've got to put into a story to make the enemy seem human. You've got to show your people are human and have their own conflicts and stresses. And one of the things I always try and work in is you're not just dealing with the enemy. You're looking. You're dealing with your chain of command and your allies. And you would think they were all on the same sheet of music, but they're not. They're never on the same sheet of music. And they're people who are hurting you and hurting your organization as much or worse than the enemy. So.
When you look at nonfiction, I guess to help set the background for your book, I mean, are you reading Mahan, or are you looking at the strategy, you know, following the Spanish American War? What is the kind of historical context in which you place your book?
Well, at the Naval War College, they used to say, amateurs study strategy, and professionals study logistics. In Jade Rooster, I point out that Cole had more influence on the U.S. Navy in 1913 than any strategy they could develop, because without coaling stations and with the limited power coal gave you in relation to the amount of space and weight it occupied in a ship, we could not go to and help Korea. We couldn't assert ourselves in Korea. Korea was a country under the boot of Japan, but we couldn't realistically take on Japan in 1913. Now, we could take it on in 1942, but by then we'd switched over to oil. So I though strategy is important, I'm probably taking a more deck plate view when I'm writing. economic warfare. I always think in terms of the Special Operations Executive and the different things they did when I'm kind of putting together a story. In terms of Mahan, I did take the command and staff course, but Special Operations still, it'll be, I can't foresee a time where we're going to be involved in a fleet versus fleet for domination of the sea lanes role. The SEALs wouldn't be essential to anything like that. Geared, of course, I can't think of us. We're more attrition in intelligence gathering, strategic targets, a precise target. But whose strategy am I reading now? Oh, I suppose I'd be watching India shortly, reading about India and how we're going to use, how we're going to position ourselves to let India help us, because there are a couple countries in that region that we want to nullify, and the American public just doesn't seem to want to, doesn't want us to go it alone, and we don't want to go, and that's probably right. So I guess how to gather allies, but again, the individual SEAL or I don't see that applying, and in 1913 even less. But I never say never, and as again, I may open a book and say, wow, and I'm back to my writing under the street lamp method, where a book gives me an idea, and I say, I'm going to tailor my story to this idea. Red Ice owes a lot to a guy named Summers, who wrote on Vietnam and our exit from Vietnam and what all the things that went wrong, and one of it was letting the careerists fight Vietnam 1 year 10 times rather than 10 times and building on it. So I guess I can't say exactly where strategy will take me, but I probably don't read as much on strategy as I used to.
Well, Roger, I want to thank you a lot for coming on this Saturday afternoon to join us. I appreciate the time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. This is all subject matter I love to talk about. Now if I can just figure out a way to write it and get paid for it.
Yeah, it's that pesky bill paying thing that always gets in the way of things. Well, I wish you the best of luck with not only your latest book, Jade Rooster, but also your upcoming one.
Why, thank you. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to both of you.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you for joining us.
I want to thank everybody for joining us live or getting us on the archive. Please join us again next week, where we will have returning guest, the ever-popular Will Dossel, to discuss ballistic missile defense and all things AEW, and I hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
Long way to Tipperary, it's a long way.